we did have fun with the webinars. Yes, in order to make sure that each of the speakers have an opportunity, if you will. Healthcare and civil rights, kind of where we stand today. I have no financial interest to disclose. Dana Bowen Matthew, in a book, wrote, after controlling for differences among the races and socioeconomic status, health insurance, access to health care, and geographic differences, the evidence still shows that blacks and Latinos receive fewer and inferior clinical services than whites, irrespective of whether those services are for the treatment of cardiovascular disease, cancers, mental illness, prenatal care, or HIV/AIDS. And that quote is, again, from the New Strategy to Combat Racial Inequality in American Healthcare Delivery, which appeared in the DePaul Journal of Healthcare, and again, written by Dana Boeing Matthew. Congress recognized that, obviously, there was some disparity and wanted to assess the extent of disparities. Basically that are received by racial and ethnic minorities, and therefore commissioned the Institute of Medicine study, again in 1999, that may look at those factors that contribute to the inequalities in care and thus to recommend policies and practices that were designed to eliminate those inequalities. When we look at some of the figures, the high blood pressure. The prevalence of high blood pressure, a major risk factor for coronary heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, and heart failure. High blood pressure is nearly 40% greater in African Americans than in whites. There are an estimated 6.4 million African Americans that have hypertension. When we look at heart and kidney disease and stroke, cardiovascular and renal disease damage are more frequent and oftentimes more severe in minority populations. African Americans continue to experience a higher rate of stroke, have more severe strokes, and continue to be twice as likely to die from a stroke as white Americans. We'll look at diabetes. Racial and ethnic minority groups, especially the elderly, are disproportionately affected by diabetes. On average, African Americans are more than two times as likely as whites to have diabetes. African Americans with diabetes, once the diagnosis has occurred, are more likely than whites to experience complications of diabetes, such as amputations of lower extremities, and end-stage renal disease. On average, American Indians, Alaskan Natives are 2.3 times as likely as non-Hispanic whites of similar age to have diabetes, and Hispanics are nearly twice times as likely to have diabetes as whites, with Mexican Americans, the largest Hispanic subgroup, more than twice as likely. When we look at malignant neoplasms or cancers, that African Americans are 21% more likely to die from all types of cancer than whites. Adjusting for age, African American men are more than 50% likelier to die from prostate cancer than are whites. Breast cancer is diagnosed 10% less frequently in African-American women than in white women, and African-American women are 36% more likely to die from the disease. In some other minority communities, cancer also takes a disproportionate toll. When we look at among Hispanics, women are more than 2.2 times more likely to be diagnosed with cervical cancer than non-Hispanic white women. Asian Pacific Islander women are 2.7 times as likely to fall ill from stomach cancer as non-Hispanic white women, and Asian American men suffer from stomach cancer 93% more often than non-Hispanic white men. We'll look at prenatal care. Mexican Americans and African American mothers are more than 2.5 times as likely as non-Hispanic white mothers to begin prenatal care very late during the pregnancy, at least in the third trimester, or some do not receive any prenatal care at all. We'll look at the numbers for uninsured. Among adults that are in the age category of 18 to 64, nearly half of Hispanics, almost 50%, and more than one of four African Americans, 28%, were uninsured during the year of 2006, compared with 21% of whites and 18% of Asian Americans. African Americans and Hispanics also experienced differential access to a regular doctor or source of care, with approximately 43% of Hispanics and 21% of African Americans reporting that they do not have a regular doctor or a source of care, compared those numbers with 15% of whites and 16% of Asian Americans. The inequality in our healthcare delivery system. The report from the Institute of Medicine studied the unequal treatment confronting racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare found that there is a consistent body of research that demonstrates a significant variation in the rates of medical procedures by the following: race, insurance status, income, age, and severity of conditions are comparable. We'll look at the injustice in the healthcare delivery in this country. The research also indicates that U.S. racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to receive even routine medical procedures and experience lower quality of health services. The report goes on to state that a large body of research underscores the existence of disparities. For example, minorities are less likely to be given appropriate cardiac medications or to undergo bypass surgery, or are less likely to receive kidney dialysis or transplants. We'll look at minorities are more likely to receive certain less desirable procedures, such as lower limb amputations for diabetes and other conditions. Despite the continued advances in healthcare, and we certainly know that there have been some advances with the implementation of Title VI, which basically bars any discrimination and did provide for the desegregation of many of our hospitals, but despite those advances in healthcare, racial and ethnic minorities continue to have more disease, disability, and premature deaths than non-minorities. So we must continue to sound the alarm and raise awareness about these disparities. We must continue to advocate for a consistent and equitable level of care, and to also level the playing field by involving more minorities in the delivery of the health care to Americans. More interpreters should also, again, be available, as we do continue to provide many of the services. Language is also a barrier that we have to, again, overcome as we look to develop that. Now, our next speaker
I'm afraid I'm not Darina Wong, as the program says, nor have I been able to upload a presentation because this was a bit of a last-minute change. My name is Anya Rudiger, and I'm a colleague of Darina's. We work for the National Health Law Program, which is based in L.A. and in D.C., and serves to advocate for the health rights of those in need. I'm also the director of the Human Right to Health Program, which is a collaborative program by the National Health Law Program, or NHELP, and the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, or NESRI, based in New York. And I want to try to do justice to what Darina would have contributed had she been able to be here with us, and also Bob Griss, who was also scheduled to do this collaborative with Darina, and both of them have asked me to come instead. And I will try to do this in the spirit of what they want me to do, but I'm also going to go a little bit further. The original objective was to introduce a new conceptual framework for incorporating civil rights into health policy and practice and increasing accountability. Now, what I would like to do is to lay out why I think we should adopt a broader framework, and that is a human rights framework, which is also, I will argue, more appropriate for a public health approach to health equities, to increasing health equity. Now, I will very, very briefly and schematically lay out the civil rights approach in health advocacy and what we have achieved and what we haven't achieved. And just to very briefly set out the legal basis for this, as I'm sure you're all aware, the main basis is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and in particular Section 601 of Title VI. And if I can quote this just to recall, no person in the United States shall, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Now, that is the law. As we just heard from Daryl, something must have gone wrong. so let me just try to briefly set out an argument here as to what has worked and what we need to do now. So there have been considerable achievements using the Civil Rights Act to address inequities in healthcare. And let me quote from an example from the National Health Law Program that Darina has given in the webinar series that we heard about. And this is related to language access, which Darina is an expert in. And the Language Access Initiative really finds its legal basis in this national origin grounds of discrimination that I just quoted. That is, we can't discriminate on the basis of national origin, and it's and that includes language. We can't discriminate on the basis of language. And so to comply with Title VI, language assistance must be given to limited English proficiency persons to ensure that they have equal access to programs and service. The Office for Civil Rights issued guidance to make sure that law is implemented, and individuals can file complaints if they feel that is being violated. The Office of Civil Rights can then also initiate reviews of agencies, and they have done so with regard to agencies funded by the Department for Health and Human Services. They've done that over the last decade about 225 times. They found agencies in violation with the principle of providing language access that is that provides for equal access for all. Now, all 50 states have language access laws, and there are federal matching funds available for language assistance services in the public programs in Medicaid and SCHIP. And the National Health Law Program is working very hard to translate these legal and policy requirements into practice and into the actual program delivery. So on the language access side, there's been some achievements. Now, where, on the same broader issue, where are sort of the key barriers? There is actually no mandates or no significant funding available for what I would term as more systemic change, and that relates to the whole context of requirements around cultural competency. Now, when we look at cultural competency, we're looking at sort of sets of behaviors and attitudes, processes and policies, all of which goes much beyond just the non-discrimination approach or even an equal access approach. It has much more to do with changing the way we work and respecting each other's dignity, meeting needs. And this is where the civil rights approach has not made great achievements in integrating that in our healthcare policy and practice. So if I can summarize on where civil rights have been effective and where not, again, drawing on the experts that reported in the webinar, especially Professor Randall, where civil rights have been effective is really reduce or eliminate segregation within healthcare facilities, to reduce direct discrimination within facilities, and as I outlined, to some extent with regard to facilitating language access for diverse groups. Now, where it's been ineffective we can name it. Everything that we see is not working. For example, all the closures of hospitals in inner cities, a huge problem. Discrimination in the quality of care received, as Daryl outlined, and provision of cultural competent care, and indeed direct discrimination by physicians. Overall, there's been no reduction in the health outcome disparities, as we've just heard. So what we have is status quo where there's huge health disparities. We have the exclusion of immigrants from public programs, and we have the whole problem of institutional racism and systemic discrimination being still with us in the health setting. So I would like to argue that we need to incorporate civil rights in a broader human rights approach to move forward. So civil rights really address equality from a perspective of non-discrimination and integration, whereas human rights, I would argue, adopt a broader equity approach that is more geared towards a systemic analysis and a normative perspective. And, of course, human rights also entail the principle of universality. So if I can sort of make a very schematic point, if you look at the equality approach at its most minimalist, it's perfectly possible that everybody just gets equally little. So it doesn't set any substantive or normative standard as to what needs to happen. It just means that it's a procedural way of looking at we all need to get the same, but it doesn't say what the same is. The same could be no health care, for example. Whereas an approach that includes universality, as human rights do, is a more substantive one in that the ultimate goal is to lift everybody up. And this includes equity, a strong equity focus, in that human rights always say you need to focus on the most disadvantaged first. So let me briefly outline what the what I mean by the human right to healthcare. A definition could be that we have a universal right to an equitable system of health protection. And everybody has the right to enjoy on an equal basis the facilities, goods, and services that are necessary for for realizing the highest attainable standard of health. And that includes access to appropriate health care on the one hand, and it includes to enjoy the conditions that allow us to be in good health. On the other hand, those would be the underlying social determinants, such as appropriate food, housing, healthy workplace conditions, healthy environment. So with regard to healthcare, we're really looking at a very very substantive goal, that this universal access to comprehensive quality healthcare for all. So that is quite different from the procedural understanding of that we all need to get the same of whatever it is that may already exist. So equity is a key human rights principle, and so I think it is really the bridge between a civil rights and a human rights approach. And if I can go back again to the colleagues who presented in the webinar, Brian Smedley did a presentation on equity, and if I just look at what health equity entails for him, and he, of course, was also one of the authors of the IOM report, he describes health equity, the elements need to include full access to care, equitable care quality, patient empowerment, strengthening healthcare infrastructure in low-income and underserved communities, strengthening the policy infrastructure, particularly with regard to enabling participation, and addressing the social determinants of health. And then he also calls for a key policy goal, which is universal healthcare. So here you see in his approach the direct link between universality and equity, and that it is a normative. These goals are normative, they're substantive, they're not just procedural goals. So again, when you look at the human right to health definition, that we have the right to the highest attainable standard of health, that is a substantive entitlement. It's an entitlement to health and not just an entitlement to equal treatment. But it's still within that equity perspective that is highest. Highest is obviously a comparative measurement. So it's a standard that is presumably achieved in this country by those who are most advantaged. So those are presumably the standard that we all should aspire to. And that's what we saw in the earlier presentation, where we're measured against those who achieve better mortality, morbidity rates. So that standard requires lifting those up who haven't yet achieved the highest attainable standard of health. So again, there's an equity principle built in, but it's broader than an equal right to, say, to buy an insurance product or to access a safety net program. So if I look at some of the, just to give an example, some of the equity standards for access to healthcare, and that's really just regarding healthcare and regarding the principle of access, which is mainly relating to how healthcare is financed and how we access care in addition to, you would have other principles relating to the quality of care and so on and so forth. But if we just look at access, clearly the human right to healthcare would require to eliminate all disparities in access to care. And that's very much linked to the second principle, which is that access to care should only be on the basis of clinical need, not on any external factors, be they payment, be they any other privilege, immigration status, what have you. And then thirdly, access to care should be the same for everyone. So getting rid of this fragmented system where some access it through a safety net, some access it through employment, some don't have any health insurance at all, but have a universal way of accessing that's the same for everybody, and the healthcare benefits would be the same. And clearly, access should not be impeded by any factors such as geographical distance or business hours or, you know, as we looked at language or disabilities, so things like that. And then also a key part of the equity principle would be to enable full participation for everybody in health system decision making on an equal basis with private and public institutions. Probably don't have much more time, do I? Let me just look at how have we tried to achieve civil rights in healthcare, and how can we achieve human rights? Now, within the civil rights approach, there has been a strong focus on legal enforcement. And our exercise of civil rights really depends on legal recognition, on government recognition. Now, taking a step back, obviously this recognition was won in a struggle. But the struggle continues, and these rights and recognitions have been rolled back in recent years, and we are spending a lot of time fighting those setbacks. For example, there's been very narrow judicial interpretation now that excludes unintentional discriminatory effects or the impact of policies and practices. That means individuals now cannot sue to enforce the disparate impact provision that is also given under Title VI, and the courts have basically dismantled that. So the tools have actually become weaker. And now with human rights are not granted to us. We have them by virtue of being human. And that, of course, includes the rights of non-discrimination and equality. Now, there's an international legal framework for that. There's unfortunately no domestic framework or no domestic legal basis, or very little. There's a little bit under, again, when it comes to the International Treaty on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So there's a little bit of legal basis that we have, but we don't really have any enforcement tools. What we do have under the human rights framework is the same principle of accountability that really government and also the private sector are accountable for protecting our health. And so this strong sense of accountability, which we also have in the civil rights framework, is present, and we now need to just figure out how we can make these entities accountable to us. And there, again, I look back on the history of the civil rights struggle, which clearly was, to a large degree, successful. It got us all this legal and government recognition. And what I would be calling for is to build on this and continue this struggle as a human rights struggle. And I do want to look back at how Dr. King perceived the element of human rights within the struggle. And it was quite clear for him that economic and social rights should be part of the civil rights movement. And he very obviously realized that basic human needs are human rights, and that this includes healthcare. And he very much wanted to go beyond this sort of desegregation approach to something more substantive goals. And the goals that he articulated really almost always included economic and social rights as goals. But the problem was that the civil rights tools, weren't quite there yet. The tools were mainly regarding fostering integration and fighting non-discrimination. And so it's those tools that couldn't address the more systemic inequities systematically. And I think the human rights framework now provides a normative and an analytical basis to drive change in health policy. And the human rights framework can really be very empowering for communities to continue that struggle, for communities that don't at this point have any control over their own health protection. So here's where I see the convergence of a public health approach and a human rights approach, which is that human rights strategies really speak fully to the health equity element of the public rights, public health approach, which includes, for example, the strong emphasis on looking at the social and economic determinants of health, or as we also say, the upstream determinants of health. And this is also based on a normative perspective that public health includes everyone. And this is a universal approach to defining and pursuing health protection. And I also want to stress that the principles of participation and accountability are really strong in the human rights framework, and they're very much in sync with public health approaches. And this is then where we would get into the significance of, for example, community-based health planning, which would sort of be the next topic of our conversation if we had more time. So thanks very much.